Bienvenidos, that's California for welcome to the March 31st edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist, an author. He's the host of the Capital Record podcast and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Hey, I would go through some small talk here because I want to find out about your life, but we have, I think, 50 minutes, it looks like, maybe? Yeah, we have a very short window here. So
we can go a little longer. I can be late for my next meeting.
Okay,
we got to cover. There's a lot going on.
There is so much going on.
Don't make me come over there and slap you.
Do you want to talk about? I hesitate even to bring it up. It's just like everywhere. But
yeah, it is everywhere, huh? And I don't think anyone's had anything particularly profound to say. It does seem like everyone who's just a regular person like feels the same way. But I guess there's been, I know that night there was at least a couple I saw on Twitter of progressive Congress folks, I think both women, but maybe there was a congressman in there that, I don't know, I'm not a biologist, that they were defending Will Smith.
Oh, man.
But they deleted the tweets. And here's the thing. I know others have said it. Most of what we could say, everyone has said. And so we don't need to go there.
Yeah.
What I have to say is more profound, I think, than the commentary everyone else has. Like, come on, it was a joke, and why? And he was up partying all night after, and he's, you know, this. How? What are we doing? Like defending this guy, and
defending Will Smith.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The only thing I was going to add is this issue of their open marriage and her talking about and him talking about her preference that they have multiple sexual partners. Yeah, and so someone else said it, and I didn't tweet it because I was going to, and they tweeted it first. But it is interesting. I'm not being funny. I don't think it's like a joke. If Chris Rock had slept with his wife, that would have bothered him less than Chris Rock telling a joke about his wife. I'm not sure how to interpret the ethics of all this or the just sensibility of it. But this whole thing of this open relationship thing is so disgusting. And of course, it's from a vocabulary standpoint, it isn't true. There's no such thing as an open relationship.
An open marriage, yeah.
You don't have an open marriage. Yeah,
by definition.
But then he was cracking up at the joke.
Yes, he was.
And then he was smacking him. And I do get, by the way, that there was a period of everyone getting all conspiratorial, like this was fake for the ratings. And it wasn't until you saw the Australian and Japanese, which apparently I didn't know you could drop F-bombs on their TV.
Oh, wow.
Oh, all the unedited. You haven't seen the unedited?
No.
Oh, it adds a lot of color to the thing.
He was mad.
No, he's screaming the F-word
in
the room. So my thought was he was drunk. I didn't think someone would act that way sober. And I think, these people party, these events and stuff, right? But then it clearly wasn't. And then it was like Denzel. And I started having deja vu because I think I watched 5 minutes of the Oscars in total in 10 years. And it was 2.5 minutes 6 years ago when Jimmy Kimmel was hosting and they gave the wrong movie the award.
Right.
And it was 2.5 minutes on replay of Will Smith.
Right.
And in both cases, the like cooler head coming in to calm everybody down was Denzel. So Denzel is really the dad of Hollywood or the grandpa of Hollywood.
Well, and I thought that his reported comment to Will Smith, which was right on. He said, you know, when you're at the top of your game or at the peak of your game or something like that, that's when the devil comes for you. He's talking about the old pride goeth before the fall. I also found the double standard just reprehensible. You know for a fact that if somebody had rushed the stage, everybody's already played these games. You know, what if Chris Rock were white and he said this? What if Chris Rock were a woman who said this?
Yeah, but I think that if Will Smith hit a white guy, I don't think anyone would have cared. I think if a white guy had hit Chris Rock, it would have been different.
Right.
And then I also would say that Amy Schumer, who was on stage that night, Wanda Sykes, who was on stage, who's the other? There's a...
What is it?
Regina Hall.
Regina Hall.
But who's the...
gosh, I'm blanking.
There's another black comedian
woman.
Very funny.
Yes.
Who also loves to... They just throw it out. They hit people hard.
Yes, right.
And I don't think anyone would say... I know everyone on the left, at least, is into this whole thing about male-female equality.
Right.
I'm pretty sure they're against a man hitting a woman, aren't they?
I think so.
I don't know. It's impossible they're not. Like, things change quickly.
Well, it was fascinating to watch the progressives break up over whether this was toxic masculinity or whether this was great to see as a few female.
Oh, yeah. They call it chivalrous. And
yes,
stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. This is.
Well, see, that's something I'm totally perplexed by. What is the difference between toxic masculinity and chivalry?
And chivalry. 100%.
It seems to me it depends on who you hit. Right?
Yes. Yeah. Race and gender.
And then I guess the thing, like, do you think Chris Rock didn't know about her having a condition?
I have no idea.
I kind of think he didn't.
I didn't know, but I'm not
sure. I didn't know. I still don't even know what it is. I've never heard the word before.
I've heard it. I have had female friends, especially, who've had it. It's what we would call, it's a condition and you lose your hair. It's not the worst. It's not like she had cancer or something.
Right.
But hair loss. I mean, let's put it in perspective. And
it just, to be honest, I kind of don't think he knew, because I don't think he would have told the joke if he did.
Right.
But because also the joke wouldn't have been funny.
Right.
The joke's only funny if you think it's like it's a look she's going for.
Right.
Right, you know what I'm saying?
It's Sinead O'Connor, right?
It isn't like he's a bad comedian.
No, he's a very good comedian. And he's a good, and he seems like a decent guy, actually. I like Chris Rock an awful lot, I will admit.
That guy is a pro.
Yes.
Because he got smacked the hell.
One of my favorite memes.
He was just like.
He flinched for one moment and then back on it. It was like, whoa, I just got
that. And until Will Smith sat down and started screaming about, you don't say my F and Y, like all the F words. He kind of thought it was going to be blown off as a joke thing. He was ready to just sort of move it forward.
Right.
And then for Will to not even mention him in his speech, and then even in his apology, he hasn't reached out to him directly, doing it on social.
Well, the Academy's feckless response in the moment,
shocking because they are normally the beacons of moral courage.
Yes, but somebody else asked me, are you really upset by the Academy and by Will Smith's behavior? It's like, I've never, ever taken my virtue signaling from those guys. You know, I just don't take their lead on these kinds of things. But for them, the big announcement, we're recording Thursday. Sorry that we're late, guys. It's on me. But I don't, their response yesterday was, Wednesday, was, hey, we tried to have Will Smith removed, but he wouldn't go. It's like, oh, really? I'm so sorry. I can't imagine any kind of security arrangement that might compel a bad person who behaves badly to leave. But anyway, that's what happened there. So
grand scheme of things, do you think it's a big deal? I do. I think it's a big deal because I think that any incident that takes place that shows the moral relativism of our age is important.
Yes.
And I think your point on toxic masculinity versus chivalry, that people don't know if it's a race thing, how do you fit? I mean, all of the just questions about everything, the double standards. I just believe, generally speaking, Hollywood is the greatest metaphor, except for it's real, but it's sort of like this fictitious symbol of the total moral confusion of our age. No one knows what to think.
That's right.
And evidenced with the Harvey Weinstein, like, this guy's solid against gun ownership.
Right.
Oh, but he's a sexual harasser. Like, what do we do?
Right.
Like, no one knows what to do with their conflicting moral platitudes.
Right. And what do you do about, and you'll pardon me for saying this, I am not endorsing sex assault or anything like that, but a lot of these relationships with Harvey Weinstein, we talked about this at the time, involved women who wanted to get something from Harvey Weinstein and were therefore willing to trade. Like that old joke, I think you and I may have even told this offline, but here goes the joke. Guy sits down at a bar, he sits next to a woman and he says to the woman, would you sleep with me for $1 million? She says, yeah, I guess I would. And he says, how about $100? She says, what do you take me for? And he says, well, we've already established what you are.
Now we're just haggling. I thought it was a Winston Churchill real life story.
Is it?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a
Winston
Churchill
story. Sat next to a lady and asked her if she would sleep with him for
there was
$1 million?
A conversation. There's a whole thing. But there's Churchills in that story. It's not just a man in a bar.
I love it.
No, Churchill was probably in a bar.
In a bar, yeah. Or
listen, I think that we've talked about before the misogyny in rap hip hop, and there's this thing where there's supposed to be a kind of like anything can go from the streets, you know, because urban violence, like with what they've had to grow up with, it's justified because it really speaks to white privilege. And then they get into trouble because there's like the rap lyrics where there's some, you know, Me Too. you can't even like comprehend what right. these guys were talking about, and they kind of have to ignore it all. I think that with Hollywood's protestations against Islamophobia and then their protestations against homophobia, that those two things have been at odds.
Yeah, sure.
In a very awkward way. For
yeah,
well,
you
time.
Get your fundamentalists throwing gay men off the tops of buildings in handcuffs in the Middle East, right? I mean, it's...
You really don't get to have it both ways.
Right.
You're going to
have... Unless
you're
in Hollywood.
Right. And then, of course, there's Ricky Gervais's response.
Yes.
Which was to go right to the class struggle hypocrisy. And that is actually the most juicy part of all this, is that these people...
Remind us of the Gervais line, because I don't remember the specific
line. Well, of course,
line,
first of all, there's
the
whole 7 minutes and 40 seconds of his monologue at the Golden Globe Awards,
yes,
the fifth
one.
And final time he hosted in January of 2020, right before the world shut down, which was just 7 minutes of the most delicious, painful...
Skewering
you've ever seen in your life. That left Tom Hanks, his face just froze where he couldn't move. He didn't know what to do at what he was hearing. And just right 50 feet from Tim Cook's face saying, Apple is no better than ISIS.
Right, so, yeah.
He just absolutely rips these people.
And then went on to say that if ISIS was suddenly in the film production business,
you call your agents.
Yes.
Well, I think that what Gervais said on Twitter Monday when they said, what would you say if you had been allowed to host the Oscars? And he said, you know, you could go after, like at the end of the day, there's nobody that these people really hate. You think they hate Christians. You think they hate white people. I don't think they really hate white people.
Most of them are white people.
I think that who they hate are poor people.
Yes.
And all of their inclusivity, they gave out a gift bag on Sunday night that cost $127,000.
Each gift bag.
Well, the items in the gift.
Yeah.
So I'm all for it. You know, I'm a big... fan of rich excessive abundance that has been supported by market mechanisms, but they don't support it allegedly.
No. Right.
And every night when they drive back to their houses in Pacific Palisades or Bel Air or Beverly Hills, they think about how awful riches apparently are and class struggle and income divide. The reputation of limousine liberals is well deserved, but it is on steroids in Hollywood because they're not only so removed economically from the people they say they most care about, they're totally removed socially. They have absolutely no interaction.
And the evidence is the handling of Will Smith after this event. Yeah. I want to take us from the sublime to the more mundane, but it's...
Do you think Will Smith's going to have to go live with his uncle now?
I think Ben Shapiro said something like
that. Oh, did he?
Yeah.
See, that's interesting because I thought I was making it up right now.
Oh, that's really good. Yeah, see?
Great Ben and minds. I think alike, but he's a lot more clever than I am.
Well, he said something like he has to go live with his uncle and aunt. Cool out. We got a great letter. Well,
we got to quit talking about it because anything I say, I think I'm being clever, and it turns out someone's already said it.
Well, you didn't know that.
I didn't know that.
So
Let's say Ben stole it from me.
Everybody listening, we all now agree Ben stole it from David. We got a number of people, that number being four, who called to correct me on something I said about the canon. You'll remember that the Russians last week, some Russian parliamentarians demanded that we return to them Alaska and parts of Sonoma County. I guess that would include the Russian River. But certainly it might include Fort Ross, they said, which they had sold, actually, to one John Sutter. And John took the canon back to his fort and et cetera, et cetera. Everybody who was here last week knows the story. If you don't, go back and listen to it. But I had said that the Alaska governor had said to the Russians, yeah, come and get it. You know, come and get Alaska. You will walk into a mess of people who are well-armed and used to hunting bigger creatures than you. And I was trying to remember where the phrase come and take it comes from. And I said somewhere in the Spartans, I thought. And yes, indeed, Kelly Moorman wrote to us and said the phrase come and take it refers originally to the 300 Spartans and others at Thermopylae in 480 BC, whose response to Xerxes and the Persians' demands they surrender their weapons was molon labe, or come and take them. And here's the big correction. I had said the canon in Texas... that the Mexican army came to try to capture. That cannon, I said, was at the Alamo. It was actually in Gonzales, the Battle of Gonzales. Kelly writes, the response was given by the residents of Gonzales, where the cannon I referred to was located, not the Alamo. It was a Spanish six-pounder presented to the citizens of Gonzales For their protection against hostile Native Americans. The Mexican military sent a detachment to retrieve that cannon in September of 1835. So this is before the big war with Mexico. This provokes the Battle of Gonzales, referred to as the Lexington of Texas, the first battle of Texas's revolution against Mexico. The battle at the Alamo took place later on in 1836. And as I say, several people did that. Thank you for the correction. If you know anything more about this particular cannon, you know, if you're a listener and you know something more about it, please let us know. You can email
me. Let Will know.
Let Will know. Thank you. Then I wanted to point out, I'm going to change up the run list here just a wee bit by starting with the news that the Pac-12 mm-hmm. is moving out of San Francisco, David. I think I sent you the AP story. The Pac-12 conference will not renew the lease on its downtown San Francisco headquarters and will have its employees work remotely instead of maintaining a permanent league office. No more permanent league office. COVID showed them how to do it, and California and San Francisco in particular made it imperative that they do this. They are looking at options in L.A., so, you know, not a big difference. Phoenix or Las Vegas. But, David, it looks like the Pac-12 is kind of pulling out of California to some extent and, you know, letting people work remotely. So you can
Pac-12 moving to Alabama.
There you go.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's our Exodus story, and we could go on. There are lots of others. But then the top news in the Kamala Harris clock, big new poll out. And the poll was the Harvard, it's called the Harvard Caps Harris poll. Of course, Harris is a big polling agency, and everybody knows Harvard, I guess. They found that Trump leads a Biden-Harris matchup in 2024. He would win, according to a hypothetical 2024 mm-hmm. matchup. The poll finds Trump getting 47. This is today, of course. This is way, way in advance of any election. These things are, you know, notoriously irregular. But mm-hmm. Trump would get 47% compared to 41% for Biden. The results are even worse for Harris in a hypothetical matchup. So let's say Biden pops out, Harris runs. 49% said they'd choose Trump. Well, 38% said they would support Harris. There was an attempt in the LA Times. Let me first move to the Hill story here. Will Kamala Harris rank as one of the worst VPs in history? You don't even have to read it too deeply here, David. I'll just say the headline tells you. This is a commentary piece, but it's a continuing kind of drumbeat. And you had said that I keep wanting to flag this because I think it's really important. You had said early on, you know, who does this serve to keep tearing down Kamala Harris? We on the conservative side who live in California and have more or less grown up alongside Kamala, we knew who she was. This is a person who only barely eked out election wins from her earliest time, got a big leg up from good old Willie Brown.
Had you ever heard Willie Brown's line about the relationship?
Yes, we actually talked about it because he wrote it while we were doing the podcast in the early days.
About she was in love with him and he was in love with him? You hadn't heard that one?
No.
I just heard it recently.
Did you just make that up?
No.
Yes, you did.
No, I did not. I did not. That Willie Brown said his relationship was perfect. She was in love with me and I was in love with me.
He is so good.
He's funny. You know he's 40 years older?
Yeah, he's an older gentleman.
No, he's 40 years older.
40.
Than her.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
That's old. Yeah. No offense to our older friends, because I'm old, but I'm not much older than Kamala.
I'm all for a guy dating a gal 40 years younger, but not her.
Well, at your age, 40 years younger would be really problematic.
How old am I? Yeah, well.
My daughter is off limits, Bonson.
I said his age.
Yeah, okay.
But listen, that's a real line that he said. And back to the point with Kamala. Finish your point unless you were going to ask
me. No, go ahead.
No, where were you going about who stands to gain by her unpopularity?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you. Yes. Who stands to gain? You said, look, it's the Dems. They don't want her running. They get what an anchor.
Well, that's obvious. So the question is, which Dems?
Any Dem who wants to see.
Wants to win.
Who wants to win the 2024
election. I would argue that that's true at a high level. And then there's a lower level truth of specific Dems. Like in other words, who wants to run? We assume Joe Biden's not going to be president at 84. Okay, I don't know if he'll be here at 84. Mm. But let's just assume he's not going to be president at 84 years old. Who benefits from whatever they're doing to Kamala, which is just a sight to behold? Now, have you ever seen anything like this?
No, but she, and of course you and I both agree, she's helping them. She provides them with constant artillery fire.
Yeah, but I think that there's a chicken or egg thing there. And here's what I mean by that. If Kamala was a likable person, if Kamala was a political talent, if Kamala had some of the electability and charisma and just talent, which is the right word in politics, because I don't generally consider charisma and all that stuff a talent, but it is in politics. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama was a remarkably intelligent man, mm-hmm. regardless of the fact that I disagree with him on mm-hmm. almost everything. But like when conservatives say, like, he was an idiot, it's yeah. like, okay, no, geez, no, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
What was it? It was Occidental undergrad.
That's right.
Columbia Law.
Oh, was it Columbia? I thought it was Harvard.
I think it was. Maybe our editor can look it up. No. Yeah.
Brian, can you find
Because the
out?
Reason why I say that is I thought it was Harvard Law, and yet he was at Columbia grad school because that's when they never could get his grades.
We
that was Columbia.
Way. Okay.
Well, so let's so this I out, may Brian. Be confused. Either way, Barack Obama was a political talent, okay, mm-hmm. obviously. And what I am suggesting is that Kamala is not.
Right.
And that's abundantly clear to anybody. I think it's Gavin Newsom who's behind some of this. And I have reason to believe that. I think people can say stuff like Washington insider establishment mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or Democratic, you know, mafia, so to speak. That whole thing, like there's some secret club where everyone mm-hmm. gets together to plot. These people don't know anything. They're specific people, their own inside team, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. their own agenda. And they're the ones that want to clear the field. The VP is always the most likely to be the next person. And what it is rather than take the risk of her going and losing, they're doing her they're doing a mercy killing.
Mm.
So I think you're right. She makes it easier. But then they're making it harder for her.
Well, it's interesting you say this about the insiders because there's a gigantic piece. I'll put it in the show notes, David. It's from the LA Times, and it says the headline is Vice President Kamala Harris and her toughest hour is keeping a tighter circle. It's a very lengthy profile of, you know, they make it sound like it's Churchill facing down the Nazis or Volodymyr Zelensky facing down Putin. It ain't. And they feature her as kind of drifting from her California supporters, who the Times insists are going to be critical to her. They make it seem inevitable presidential run. So it's interesting because maybe it's less that she's cutting them off than they are being peeled off by some other force. These are the major donors who helped Kamala's rise and have helped support her into the VP job. But this is a person who fundamentally couldn't even win California. She was polling terribly here during the primary. She's polling terribly everywhere. So the idea that somehow, boy, all she really needs is for these old Californians who backed her to, you know, be invited back in by Kamala. But she's become kind of, they depict her as, you know, lacking in charisma. They compare her unfavorably to Jerry Brown. They say Jerry Brown had like 50,000 people in his Rolodex and loved keeping in touch with them. And that she doesn't. She keeps a much smaller circle of friends. So it's David Bonson versus Will Swaim. I'm the guy with, you know, who keeps a very small circle of friends. And you have connections everywhere.
Well, don't confuse connections for friends.
Okay.
You have more friends than I do.
By choice. You choose to keep a tighter circle. I think that, you know, part of what's interesting is to watch.
I just think that we have to distinguish between people on the left that are put off by Kamala for totally different reasons than you and I are. I do find her personality off-putting. I do find her laugh, cackle, annoying, all that stuff. That's not why she's never going to be our president.
No, of course not.
I would argue that she stands for nothing, that she's an intellectual lightweight, that she's compromised, all of those things. Fundamentally for them, they just see someone who's a narcissist, who is totally incapable of thinking on her feet, who is inarticulate, who is unremarkable and unaccomplished. You know, the left is funny in a lot of ways because they're ideologically distorted and their worldview is polluted but they still do have a certain meritocratic bias a lot of the time. And they would celebrate Bill Clinton being a Rhodes Scholar and right. Obama having overcome right. all the things he overcame. And then you get to Kamala and they're like, who is this? She's just she's not one of us.
Right.
And I think that's why they're shooting her.
And though she is a capitulation on Biden's part to the progressive left in making sure that it's a woman who is of some marginalized, she's a person of color, Indian and Jamaican, I think it is. But what's really interesting about that is the progressives hate her, of course, as we've talked about a lot. She was very much a kind of, I had said early on when she was running for president that her natural path would have been to be, hey, look at me, I'm black, I'm a woman, and I'm tough on crime. That was the reputation she was trying to cultivate here in California.
Every time you bring this up, and other people have criticized her for that stuff, and remember Tulsi Gabbard hammered her for marijuana stuff. All of it's true. You're mm-hmm. right. But I would just point out that it isn't that was the real Kamala either.
No, of course not.
That was the opportunistic thing. Like, it's better for me politically to be tough on crime,
right.
and then it wasn't.
That's exactly right.
And the next
right.
thing you know, she's on Twitter saying, we're going to pay the legal bills of the rioters.
Yes. Well, that and showing up at the bedside of, a kid who wrestled with cops, I want to say it was in Wisconsin, and then got shot while trying to get back into his car and or grab a gun. And she shows up at his bedside and declares him a hero, right? So she
was wrong because he wasn't a hero.
That's right.
But I want to make a bigger point now off Kamala. 100% of the time when a big national politician shows up with someone involved in a local incident, I find it distasteful.
Inserting themselves into a tragedy and saying, look at me.
And even if there is a clear line of the good guy and the bad guy, I think that sort of exploitation is unbecoming.
Agreed. If you're wondering, what has become of Kamala in the last couple of weeks, because she had this big moment where the administration pushed her into the showdown with Putin, and she was over in Europe and rallying support.
That YouTube is the best thing I've ever
seen.
It's
a debacle to
watch. No, it's the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Better than a face slap?
I would rather, I swear on my life, I'm not being funny right now. You can't laugh, no water, no
water
coffee.
For me.
I'd rather Will Smith smack me in the face than have that YouTube circulating of me that is circulating of Kamala Harris.
Yeah. Well, so I went and I looked around like, where is she? She has fallen off the map.
Yeah.
We've got one of the greatest crises in international affairs, and our VP is, and I found these here's three examples. Of where Kamala's up to. Here's March 29th headline in the Miami Herald. Jamaica Prime Minister to meet with VP Kamala Harris as White House works on Caribbean relationships, or Caribbean if you prefer. So she's going to the Caribbean. Then we have VP Kamala Harris to travel to Mississippi. And even in Mississippi, this was not even the biggest story on the local websites. The story, I looked it up. If you go to the homepage of most of these major outlets, like I went to a couple of TV stations that just put out this press release, basically, hey, Kamala Harris is coming to Greenville, Mississippi, where she's going to talk about the administration's investments in small businesses and communities. The story is way down the list of trending stories. Just below the naming of the new Columbus Chamber of Commerce director, some local Chamber of Commerce director, and just above Tupelo Schools showcase new bus cameras. That's how little that story matters. She has now been given the assignment to really promote. I love this headline. This is from the Associated Press. U.S. plan aims to end racial and ethnic bias in home appraisals. They will end it. They're just going to end it. There will no longer be racial or ethnic bias in home appraisals. That's Kamala's new mission. She says at the White House, she says, Black and Latino people have often had to pay more for their mortgage, receive less when they sell the home, and are less able to access home equity lines of credit. Our administration...
It's nonsense.
Agreed. And this is her major claim, that appraisers
are
likely...
Are lenders in the business of wanting to give loans?
Yes!
Is that the revenue model?
Yes. Okay. They want to give loans.
Yeah.
Yes. And her complaint is they tend to undervalue.
So they're hiring the Dukes of Hazzard to do a appraisal to screw up the loan amount and make us money.
That's right.
You know what? You understand how stupid this is?
100%. Yes. But right. This is where Kamala is now.
Tackling the 2022 problem of appraisals.
That's right.
By the way, the problem with appraisals is the values are way too high. That's your
there's your problem.
So I have a question. Does she ever run? This is the thing I think you have to imagine is happening, that they're trying to make life so miserable for her that she makes the decision. This is not for me. Washington, I can do more for my community going back to L.A. or back to San Francisco or whatever. Her husband's rich. They can they can do things. She's already made history. She was a black woman who was vice president. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I do not believe that they're going to let her run.
Yeah.
I already know she's going to lose. I don't believe they're going to let her run. They're killing this woman.
Yeah.
I feel bad for her.
Switching to the...
You don't feel bad for her?
No, because my sense is that you and I talked about this with regard to Clay Helton, the USC football coach, and my argument was when you're performing badly, you are letting a lot of other people down. It's not an issue of arrogance and it's not an issue of stick-to-itiveness. When you are completely dismantling, look at you looking at me that way with scorn and contempt. I know what you think. Fight on. But my
analogy is a terrible one.
Well, here's the deal with Kamala. She is now, she knew
what is
she
the
was
talent
unqualified.
It takes to be vice president?
I think that you ought to be prepared to take the number one job.
Okay, so besides that, Joe's not dead yet. Other than that,
you should
need to go to Tupelo, Mississippi to talk about appraisals.
I guess this
she's
is
doing
it.
That.
We know that this is how the VP is. What is it? It's not worth a bucket of warm spit.
There's two kinds of VPs. There's ones that are hired to be VP, like to maybe be sort of a second chair president, Al Gore, mm-hmm. Dick Cheney.
Right.
And then there's
Dick Cheney.
And then there's ones that were put on the ticket to help get elected.
Right. And that's all she was.
But that's fine. That's half of the VPs we've ever had.
All right. Fair enough.
And what did Biden say? I'm picking a black woman.
Yes.
So he was down to two people. And it was either her or Susan Rice, right?
Yeah.
Actually, wasn't there that congresswoman in L.A.?
Yes.
Yeah, what was her name?
She's still around, and now she's our Secretary of State, and it'll come to me. I'm so embarrassed.
No, she's not Secretary. Oh, no, the State Secretary of State.
Yeah.
What's her name?
It'll come to me. Somebody out there, tell me. It'll come. We've got it in our stories here elsewhere because we're going to talk about reparations and, So, anywho.
That's insulting, too. Kamala Harris was a presidential candidate who was a senator in California and prior to that was attorney general. And at the last hour, Biden was still looking at someone. We don't even know her name.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing some of the articles you and I have circulated point out is apparently, and this is not coming from conservatives or lunatics like Gateway Pundit or something. This is like Politico, New York Times. They say Jill Biden, not Joe, Jill by Dr. Jill Biden.
Right.
That's one of the funniest.
Talk about over-credentialed.
That's one of the funniest things that I've ever seen in my life.
That is, yeah.
That debate about her.
They've settled. By the way, I was told by a lefty listener that they have fundamentally settled on calling her Jill, kind of like Barack.
I was all fine to call her Dr. Biden, and then I read her dissertation, and
it's
now
awful.
I don't even want to call her Jill.
Yeah.
I just call her J-Bird. All right?
I want to turn to the iron law of unintended consequences. You and I talked about this last summer when the state legislature proposed and approved and the governor signed off on a bill that would commit $35 million for monthly cash payments to qualifying expectant mothers and young adults who had recently left foster care. So it's a guaranteed basic income bill that passed with a load of abstentions from Republicans who just said, you know, like, this is not even the business of government. We refuse to vote. But a few Republicans said, like, look, man, you know, when it comes to expectant mothers and young adults who are leaving foster care, yeah, maybe we want to help those people out. Like, this is just a bridge for them in a very difficult time in their lives. But that bill, and I want to emphasize this, the bill was for $35 million for monthly cash payments to qualifying expectant mothers and young adults who recently left foster care. And here's the unintended but utterly predictable consequence, David, that this has now become pet projects for a bunch of cities around California to pick, not expectant mothers, not kids who are recently leaving foster care. Here's a story out of Palm Springs. Guaranteed income program for transgender residents mulled. I love the verb. So All of this comes out of that Assembly Bill 65 for all the money for expectant moms and foster kids. And now it's the city of Palm Springs will allocate $200,000 to develop a guaranteed income pilot project for transgender and non-binary residents. No expectant mothers, no foster kids, transgender and non-binary residents.
What's non-binary again?
Non-binary is that they do not identify as either male or female.
Okay.
So the story continues.
Do non-binary identify as something?
Yeah, non-binary.
No, what's that mean?
It just means that they are neither male nor female.
They're not saying they're both.
No.
It's neither.
They are neither.
Is there another word for both?
Long period of silence over here.
Do you have a flashcard for this? So non-binary means that I'm neither male nor female.
I choose not to identify.
And is that a thing of like it's how I feel day by day, or is it permanent?
Might be.
I'm permanently neither male nor female.
It's the political equivalent of independent voters.
Okay.
The LA Times story continues. City council members voted unanimously Thursday to pay a nonprofit group called Health and Queer Works to design the program and apply for the state funding. The first of three phases outlined in a city report to bring the proposed project to fruition. They use the word fruition. How it works, they're going to give between $600 and $900 to 20 participants who identify as transgender, non-binary. I could go on, but the point here is that this all comes out of a state program that was designed for, it was sold as utterly something different. Now, David, you know, everybody here knows, that there was a time when I was on the left and I absolutely would bristle when I would hear people talk about the gay agenda. And all that really meant, it's clear, was, look, this is just the leading edge. This is the camel's nose under the tent flap. This is how it starts, and it will ineluctably evolve into something different. And it has here. And not just here, but also in West Hollywood, where I've got this somewhere, but what's the guy's name at UCLA, libertarianish kind of lawyer, Volokh? The Volokh conspiracy is his calling.
Yeah,
great guy. I mean, yeah. Super smart. He disagrees with him on some stuff, but a very, very bright guy. And he wrote a column recently that West Hollywood has a very similar program. His headline on his little blog post at the Volokh conspiracy is called, if I remember correctly, Straight People Need Not Apply. West Hollywood, famously a very gay kind of community, is now going to give out money to marginalized LGBTQIA plus people because, of course, they suffer more abuse than other people who are poor.
Now, hold on.
Please.
I am not saying that LGBT and the other ones you said, other initials I missed, are not in cases marginalized and treated poorly. I'm not saying that.
Right.
But it does seem in West Hollywood they're not.
No, I would think not.
I mean, what am I missing from their viewpoint? Okay?
From their viewpoint, again, this is the hierarchy of, or the intersectionality, right? So it's within the gay community, the people who are least likely to be hurt are gay men.
Okay.
And because they're men. And then it's, you know, perhaps black gay men. And then it's lesbian women. And then it's, black gay women. Anyway, you get the picture. It's like a decision tree that breaks out infinitely.
With more pain and suffering as you go down the tree.
Yes, the greater the victimization. So within the community of West Hollywood, they look around and they go, well, you know, all the gay white guys get great jobs because they're men and they're white.
Okay, so there's problems of intersectional mistreatment in West Hollywood, but it's not with the gays. It's with the other subdivisions of one's identity.
Right. Yes.
All right.
Yeah. So, again, I just want to point out that $35 million was sold to us for one purpose is now being used for another. There you go. The iron law of unintended consequences. But as one of our listeners told me years ago, there's no such thing as an unintended, but utterly – these may be unintended, but they are utterly predictable consequences.
Yeah.
I want to return to a story that we talked about. Oh, here's the Volokh conspiracy. Straights need not apply for City of West Hollywood guaranteed income pilot project. So that's Eugene Volokh.
Yeah,
at UCLA.
It was a fun read.
Yeah. So I want to return just for a moment to the Disney story, which continues to metastasize. One of the great stories, this popped up. I read it first on National Review. Caroline Downey, who always writes so wonderfully about education and these other kinds of social issues, got hold of something that first was obtained, a video obtained by the journalist Christopher Rufo, who you might follow on Twitter and elsewhere. He's a really good writer, and he's right on top of education issues and this sort of thing. But he got a video which it's a staff meeting in California, a staff meeting of Disney's L.A. employees, all of them discussing Florida's recent enactment of the Parental Rights in Education Bill. That's what, of course, our friends on the left called Don't Say Gay. And she says that she was advancing, quote, a not at all secret gay agenda to insert queerness into children's animation. A family-friendly theme, if you ever thought of one. So this woman's name is LaToya Ravino. She's executive producer for Disney Television Animation, also known as DTA, and or DTVA. There we go, television. She says, here's the quote, it's worth reading. In my little pocket of proud family Disney TVA, that is television animation, the showrunners were super welcoming to my not at all secret gay agenda. Maybe it was that way in the past, but I guess something must have happened. And then like all that momentum that I felt, that sense of, oh, I don't have to be afraid to have these two characters kiss in the background. I was just, wherever I could, adding queerness. No one would stop me, and no one was trying to stop me. She goes on to talk about how much she loves Disney's content, grew up watching all the classics. She'd heard that Disney was conservative, so she was so surprised. She says, my experience was baffling the opposite of what I had heard about Disney. She talks specifically, she's the executive producer of an upcoming Disney Junior musical series featuring The Roots. You remember The Roots. And it's the music of The Roots in a series called Rise Up, Sing Out, which tackles, this is a quote from the show, tackles the subject of coming together to fight racism and celebrate Black culture. And LaToya is universally heralded throughout the Disney Corporation. And then, you know, Disney employees continue to speak truth to power, telling the company they demand the company speak out against the Florida bill. Here's a headline. Disney pledges to fight Florida's Don't Say Gay bill after an employee walkout. Yes, employees walked out. They had a big demonstration. The law goes into effect on July 1st, and the backlash against the Disney CEO. What is it? You pronounce his name differently than I did. Bob Chapek? Chapek? He's the CEO.
Uh-huh.
We discussed him last week. Anyway, Chapek says, you know, he's told people I let you down and I won't anymore. And he's ticked off at Ron DeSantis for signing the bill in the time between we last spoke about this issue. DeSantis has signed the bill. And this guy Chapek says, the Don't Say Gay bill should never have passed, should never have been signed into law. Our goal as a company is for this law to be repealed by the legislature or struck down in the courts. And we remain committed to supporting the national and state organizations working to achieve that.
Was his next sentence, and we will keep Disney World shut down until it does?
I wish to God that's a great idea. They should.
But I would think he will based on how upset he is.
He's very upset. Yeah.
I mean, they're going to stop at nothing.
Except. Okay, so here's the big...
How come that's not what they should do?
This is exactly what they should do.
Why would they allow? Because there's sales tax in Florida, right?
That's true.
And property tax.
Yes.
So they're basically, if you think about it, they're
funding.
Giving the money. They're funding. It's the equivalent to like gas chambers.
Yes.
They're funding it.
100%. Yeah. They're putting the people on the trains.
This stuff is just exhausting. I'm telling you, it's not even like I get mad and I don't get. And I'm not apathetic because I do really find it awful, but I don't really know how to describe the emotion. I'm just so sick of it,
yeah.
And it is so stupid.
Well, we run that risk.
And you just cannot believe there's grownups out there. I know people fake stuff all the time, but this now has become, usually it's incredibly transitory. Like you have to feign outrage for a camera on a given event. Or you have to feign sadness, you know, the famous cliche of crocodile tears. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. the notion that people have to live their lives with this posture of being upset about something that they don't give a rat's ass about is simply mind-numbing to me.
Well, it's the crisis machine, right? It's we've always got to have a crisis. We've got the climate crisis. We've got the crisis in income inequality. We've got the crisis, of course, in what we're talking about, in racism. It's a crisis. The incarceration of – I read a wonderful Cal Matters story in which the writer – and I love Cal Matters. I think it's a really good place to go for news. But the reporter on incarceration and reparations, which we're going to come to next, suggested that because blacks are overrepresented in the prison system, that we can only conclude it's only about race. And I'm not arguing that it's not about race, but that it is only about race that we see this unequal, this disproportionate impact on black community. But the guy actually cited Foucault. Now, he didn't use Foucault's name, but he used all the nomenclature associated with Michel Foucault, the famous French deconstructionist, in talking about prisons as something that is only aligned with the patriarchy, whiteness, and capitalism, as if somehow there were never prisons before capitalism, or that prisons don't exist in non-white cultures. It's a weird thing, but it appears in this story. You could tell this guy was probably signaling to his friends back in the grad school cohort he came up with that he remembered his Foucault. So the story I want to talk about is California reparations. Here's the headline: California reparations to be limited to descendants of enslaved people. This gets back to the intersectionality we were just talking about. So most of our listeners will know that California's Governor Gavin Newsom signed into law a bill that would create a commission to study reparations and figure out how California can reward people who had suffered under slavery. But again, it quickly metastasized into, well, wait a minute, what's a person who has suffered from slavery, to include people who were merely black, or even people who were mixed race but could claim, like, I feel 50% aggrieved because of the 50% of me that's black. It became this big debating point, and there was a big showdown this week when the commission voted 5-4 and said they will only offer reparations to the formerly enslaved, descendants of the former.
By the way, just for the record, I assume you're in the same boat I am of being opposed to the whole concept of reparations.
Safe assumption.
If I bought into the premise of reparations, that there was damage done that now passed down multiple generations, the broad effects of which have been debilitating to members of the black community, then I actually am on the side of those that say the specific lineage to actual enslaved is irrelevant.
Hmm.
So, like, the by their logic, the problem is that it's untrue that people 150 years later are entitled to financial remuneration for non-specific things that did not affect them in a direct way, that is paid by people who didn't do it.
That's right.
But once you accept the logic of there's this esoteric culprit and an esoteric victim around a non-specific thing that has this kind of tracking that we can all agree, you know, it was this awful damaging stain in our society. Once you accept that premise, then I don't see a reason why you have to actually prove exactly what your great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather, you know what I mean? You may as well just open up the checkbook. And really then, I don't know. Think you stop at the black race, because I think you could then say, let's just go into Native American, Hispanic,
Irish,
the Japanese internment camps.
Absolutely.
And then the Irish, which that one gets to a point to kind of poke the bear a bit because they're white.
Yeah, fair.
And yet there was this huge mistreatment. And so you end up going like, well, what are we going to do with this one?
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, in the end, I think you could end up having people whose great-great-grandfather owned slaves.
Yes.
They could get paid.
That's right.
If you kind of play with this stuff enough.
Absolutely.
But only using their logic.
Well, this is one of the great ironies. In my family, there was a guy named William Swaim.
I know that guy.
You know that guy? Yeah, he was called the Fighting Patriot. He was an abolitionist. He is in my family's direct line, my dad's family in North Carolina. And he ran an abolitionist newspaper in North Carolina in the 1830s. And as family lore goes, was invited out of Greensboro, North Carolina, by a group of well-armed men, and then run down in a mysterious, not automobile accident, but run down by a horse carriage. under mysterious circumstances and murdered, basically. He died. He never recovered from that accident.
As an abolitionist.
As an abolitionist. And here's where it gets really kind of fun.
No, but I think, though, that's he was a victim
of white racism.
Of white racism.
Yes, 100%, because he was calling loudly for freedom of the enslaved. Now, here's where it gets really interesting.
And you're related to him.
I am. Yeah. It's really weird. Both newspaper editors, same name, separated by just a few years.
What are you going to do with the money?
Well, here's where it gets really interesting, because playing along with this line, one of the things that so it's not just enslaved, but it's anybody. The commission kind of cut the baby in half here, and they said, this is a disgusting image. They said that they would, and way too much on point with Gavin Newsom's abortion tourism. But anyway, the commission decided that it wouldn't just be people who could prove lineage to an enslaved person, but anybody who could prove that they were directly related to a black person who had arrived in the U.S. before 1900. The assumption being that if you arrived here in 1899 and you were black, you were still going to suffer the ravages of, say, Jim Crow and just, you know, embedded white racism. So, and I just want to point out that given that little story, that little anecdote about my family, one of my boys took the, what is it called, 23andMe test, and it turns out that this son of mine, my wife is a Viking. I mean, this boy's mom is as white as they come and can trace their lineage back to Scandinavia. But this boy turns out to have 5% African in him. Sub-Saharan Africa. And so I've already encouraged him to go look into, this family lineage with an abolitionist who lived in North
Carolina.
Now
that you mention it, if they go with this and take it all the way to its logical conclusion, 23andMe is going to be the most profitable.
I think, yes, this is going to spark genealogical interest that we have not seen outside the Latter-day
Saints.
And
then I want to know what the percentage cutoff is and why. Because I assume that not everyone's going to come up 100% on some of it. And yet, are we to say that 73% is not enough to have experienced victimhood? But then I want to know what the precedent is. Well, I guess I would not want to hear it from some conservative white male. Right. I want to hear from a liberal. And the one I could think of that comes to mind right now is Liz Warren. Mentioned
yes.
She dunked on Trump when it turned out she was 0.00019% Native American.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole thing obviously backfired on her. But, I mean, that was her read was, see, it turns out I am.
Yeah.
So does this mean that what the cutoff will end up being some percentage that is incredibly marginal? I think what we do is everyone in the world, no, not the world, everyone in America cuts a check to everyone else in America for the same amount.
Could we cut out the middleman and just write the check to ourselves?
And we all just
switch
hand
checks.
Off the checks.
Yeah, a lot easier.
And we're just Venmo. like a big group Venmo.
Venmo reparations. Yeah. It was fascinating. There was this one element in the committee hearing that I just really loved because they had a Zoom call so that people who couldn't be in attendance could call in. People called in from all over the country. It was a pretty weird sort of conversation. You can see some of this online. The committee says that this can only go to slave descendants, and when its critics say that, when its critics point out, look, California never participated in slavery. It just didn't. We were brought into the nation as a free state. Slavery was not only not practiced here, it was not tolerated. I've told the story online about the famous woman, Biddy Mason, who showed up as a slave brought here by a white settler from Texas and who was rescued by a very multi-culti group of sheriffs, deputies, and a posse. Latin America, we had guys from Mexico in that group who came with the sheriff of L.A. County, who helped rescue this woman and other slaves who'd been brought here illegally into the state. And it's just remarkable to me that then they turn around and say, well, you know, so it's enslaved people and Californians have to pay for this. And when you point out that California never tolerated it, they say, yo, whoa, wait a minute. But slavery may not have been practiced here. But then they talk about modern racism, redevelopment agencies or, you know, the mortgage industry and the appraisals. And that they bring up all the things that happened post-slavery that lots of other people in the commission were saying, like, oh my gosh, well, that's why we got to give it to all black people. So anyway, this does encourage a kind of tribalism. And it's and when you think about it, it's exactly what happened to Native American tribes when they were granted the right to run casinos. Suddenly, you had loads of applicants for tribal membership, and the tribes became very, very conservative on who they let into the group, because it would break up the amount, it would have further claims on this pot of cash that they could generate out of a casino. So they wanted to limit the number of people who could tap the casino and say, I'm a member of the Juanino tribe or whatever. And they're, no, you can't come in. They've set up very rigorous barriers to claim that you are actually a Native American. Keeping with our theme of diversity, equity, and inclusion, California community colleges are now going to add DEI competencies to their faculty evaluations. And I've just, you know, we just talked about within the last 2 weeks how the community college system has 20% fewer applicants because there were scams being run on it by Russian hackers who got into the system and then swept it clean of federal aid amounting to the millions. So 20% of the supposed student population in community colleges in California were just ripping us off at the state and federal levels. This organization, the community college system in California, cannot run its own campuses. They can't. But now they're going to say that if you want to teach here, you will be judged on your ability to respond to diversity, equity, and inclusion sorts of metrics.
A little plug, if you don't mind, for Please. My other podcast.
You have another podcast?
The Capitol Record, also incubated at National Review, like this podcast, Radio Free California. This week is entirely devoted to the subject of what you call DEI, what I call DIE.
DIE, I love it.
I think that this subject about diversity, equity, inclusion in corporate America, my guest this week makes the argument that the problems we face in woke America, corporate America, come back to the college system.
Yes.
And I'll let him connect the dots and not rehash on Radio Free what I talk about in the other podcast. But if
who is your guest in this case?
His name is Kenan Spivak.
Oh yeah, we met him here at the National Review Institute.
You sat at the table with him.
That's exactly right.
Longtime investment banker, well known guy on Wall Street. He's become a friend, smart guy, and very, very passionate on this subject. And that Capitol Record episode just posted today, Thursday. So I would have people check that out because I think the way we're bringing it up here on Radio Free about the education system, it actually is foundational to so many other things.
I would like to see corporate America, if they're going to include DI, diversity, inclusion, and equity, I'd like to see them include some metric for national security or something like that. Like, you know, because if you look at corporations that are focusing on issues of identity or, you know, pick your favorite flavor of the month kind of issue, shutting the climate change, shutting down. And this is part of environmentalism, of course, which is being pushed on corporations.
My favorite flavor of the month is generally Rocky Road.
You do love the Rocky Road.
I do love Rocky Road.
Is that your favorite? Really?
No, because sometimes I am in a lighter mood, not so chocolate forward. And it might even be something more like a mint chip. So you get a little chocolate situation in there, but it's a little more refreshing.
Yeah, I like that.
But here's what I would like. Instead of adding more criteria to DEI or DIE.
Make money?
Hire the most qualified candidate who can best help your company service their customers.
Right.
Let's try that.
Yeah, I love that idea. That's crazy, though.
See what happens.
Sticking with unintended consequences, one more story here. Yeah. How about that? There's a great story in the Mission Local, which is a little website that just does some phenomenal work in the Bay Area. The headline for this one is San Francisco is now boycotting most of the United States. Here, for those who love the Wiener Watch.
Well, the feeling is mutual.
Yeah. Let me just read what the city found. The city's administrator found that San Francisco will not enter into contracts with businesses headquartered in most of the United States, 28 states in all. Official travel to those states is forbidden. This list includes some surprises: Nevada, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Wisconsin. As a result of the vast boycott, the report says, San Francisco is constraining the number of businesses it can ink deals with, which all but certainly inhibits quality and drives up costs. It also adds onerous time constraints to the contracting process, which leads to poor outcome and also drives up costs. Guess who created the ordinance in 2016 that started banning travel to states? Scott Weiner. When he was then a supervisor in San Francisco. And his whole target, of course, being Scott Weiner, was no travel to states with repressive anti-LGBT laws. Now, here's what's interesting about this ban. It has Weiner thinking in ways, the writer says, that are more nuanced, though the law he initiated is not. The quotes from Weiner are worth reading. Let me just read it real quickly. I'll be honest, over time, I have come to have mixed views on the approach. On the one hand, I believe in using our dollars to express our values. When you have a state like Florida right now, which is about to enter into an act, it's horrific. Don't say gay bill. The law of the idea of spending our public dollars in Florida is an affront. On the other hand, we know an awful lot of Floridians, maybe the majority, don't support the law. And there's a huge LGBTQ community in Florida, including many owned businesses. We're sweeping in an entire state and sweeping in businesses owned by people who are trying to help. So it's kind of complicated, and I've become very conflicted.
Okay, so
I argue with myself.
Okay, so he's changed his mind.
He's changed his mind.
What's wrong with that? That's good.
No, it's awesome.
All right.
But then it's this guy who continues to come up with new bills that become law that have equally predictable, if unintended, consequences. Here's the latest. He wants California to become a legal refuge for transgender youth and their families.
Where right now it's not?
That's right. He wants nonprofits that support insurrection to lose the tax-exempt status in California. So in other words, if you are in any way connected to promoting January 6th style stuff. But all of this stuff
It's completely performative.
Yeah. Can I have one more story for you?
I don't have a choice.
You do not. I'm going to keep you here. This may be one of the great stories of the week. Assemblyman Kevin Kiley, who's running for Congress out of Placer County, is just a wonderful young guy. He is phenomenal. I say young. He's close to your age, David.
Yes.
He proposed a bill that, given what's going on with gas prices in America, we don't have to even give you the background on that. He proposed suspending or eliminating the gas tax to reduce by 50 cents the price of gasoline at the pump. The governor and the assembly opposed this, and the state senate. So the legislators and the assembly committee listening to Kevin Kiley's bill, AB 1638, they hijacked the bill. They can do this in a committee. They take your bill, they amend it, and then they vote for it.
Right.
So they took his bill to eliminate the gas tax, and they added amendments with Alex Lee from San Jose.
Only do that with the appropriate protocol, but yeah, they can do it.
Yeah, they do. It's a parliamentary procedure.
Yes, it is.
They cut off Kylie's microphone when he protested. This was not at all the intention of his bill. And what did they amend it to do? Raise oil taxes.
Yeah.
So you take a bill that is intended to ease suffering of people who buy
petroleum.
Yeah, but
it is a parliamentary thing, because they could easily just, with the same number of votes, just introduce a new bill to do the taxes. All they were doing was amending around it. It's somewhat ironic, I think, is your point.
My point is that it's ironic, and it's also fascinating that they did not want their names on the bill. Nobody.
Yeah, well, that's interesting.
Not one person wanted his or her
name
on
this Maryland bill. And Georgia right now, the lowest gas taxes, price of gas in the country.
Is that right?
They both cut taxes.
And Maryland is Democrat, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah. All right. Well, we could go on, but there's so much else to talk about and so much else to do today. I think, David, that's all the time we have.
You crushed it, my friend.
All right. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe. And, of course, rate and review the show wherever you subscribe. That helps boost our profile, and that helps others find us. Email us your comments and story suggestions, as so many of you do. I cannot thank all of you enough, Tony Lima, Chris Morton, and others who sent stories this week, and our letter writers who occasionally have cause to correct us. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks, as ever, to show producer Sarah Schutte, engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi and metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima. ¶¶